This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Thursday, January 2nd, Nick Colas, co-founder of DataTrek Research, gives his market's narrative for the coming year.
I'm not as optimistic that we'll see those really healthy comps in Q1 and Q2.
We hear from Bloomberg's Scott Soschnick on the life of former NBA Commissioner David Stern.
David always took particular enjoyment in social change.
And we'll look at how the media landscape has changed in the past few decades.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
2020 is here, and many investors wonder what the narrative will be for markets in the coming year. Nick Colas, co-founder of DataTrek Research, breaks down the market narratives from 2018 and 2019. He spoke earlier with Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney.
Hockey stick growth, that is what people are expecting for the first quarter, the first half of 2020. I want to talk about the consensus idea that we have here, which is that the first half of the year will be front-loaded in terms of gains in the S&P and beyond as companies report earnings that are solid and show steady growth in the U.S. economy. Do you agree with that consensus call?
I think it's a bit tough, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the first half of last year, you saw that S&P 500 companies registered revenue growth of 5% in Q1 and 4% in Q2, and that trailed off to 3% and then 2%, what we're expecting for the fourth quarter. And those are tough comps because the U.S. economy and global economy is still growing only fairly slowly, and even though the effect of Fed rate cuts and perhaps a trade war settlement will spur business spending, it'll be in the back half of the year. So I'm not as optimistic that we'll see those really healthy comps in Q1 and Q2.
So, Nick, I'm looking at your research note, and I love your theme here, six-word market narratives. Give us your six-word market narratives for 2018, 2019, and maybe how we should think about 2020.
You know, the six-word narrative is an exercise to try to just distill down what happened in 2018, 19, and what could happen this year. The summary of it was that 2018 was a year of a huge policy mistake. The Fed thought that neutral rates were much higher than they were. You know, Jay, don't touch that dial is kind of the six-word market narrative. In 2019, we had a reversal of that. Basically, the Fed came out on January 4th, apologized for getting it wrong, and spent the rest of the year cutting. So it was, okay, we know you're sorry, it's okay.
Right.
2020 is going to be this issue of, look, there's 100 different ways to cut this market and say you shouldn't be involved. Valuations are very high. Corporate debt's very high. We talked about the earnings comps, all very real issues. But at the same time, we still have the flow through of these policymakers, both at the Fed now saying they're not going to raise rates and in the White House saying, you know what, the trade war probably should be over because President Trump wants to get reelected. And it's a flow through of those two narratives that says this year might be okay.
All right, let's talk about where it's going to be most okay. I was looking at the Citi Economic Surprise Index for both the U.S. and Europe. This morning in the U.S., it's going down and it is negative. In Europe, it's the highest level since February 2018, basically meaning that the economic data coming out was beating expectations by the most since then. Do you agree that this sort of supports the narrative that Europe will outperform the U.S.?
At an economic basis, on a relative basis, meaning they're going to grow a little faster on a quarter-over-quarter sequential basis, absolutely. The issue with Europe as a stock market is it's so little exposed to technology. The IFA index is only 7% technology, and that includes Japan, obviously, but developed non-U.S. U.S. here, we're 31% tech between tech, Amazon, Google, and Facebook. So you really have to make a very big bet on financials, which is fine. European financials have done really well in the fourth quarter and should continue to do well as bond rates continue to rise. So it's a good story. It's just not the same kind of story as the U.S. market. I still like the U.S. market better, but it's for that tech exposure.
So typically after a very strong year like we had in 2019, up 28, 29% in the S&P, what does your research show to what the markets tend to do in the year after?
Well, here's the good news.
Okay, let's start with the good news.
The good news
is... Which means he has more bad news.
Yes.
Carry on.
The good news is you don't see markets puke the next year. The market is pretty efficient, and it tends to see through. The only time we had a really bad sequential year after a great year was 1937. Market was down 38%. 37, 38. And then, but on average, you do about 10% is the short answer to your question. You don't do as well as average because there is a little bit of pull forward, but you tend to have another good year. The problem is the win rate's not as good. On average, S&P win rate 72% since 1928. Against these years, it's more like 60%, so a little bit closer to a coin toss.
We had Torsten Slok on earlier from Deutsche Bank, and he was talking about something that you mentioned, the Fed supportive markets, and talking about the correlation between the increase in the Fed's balance sheet and increases in the S&P 500. Granted, it's not a long time set. Do you, though, believe that the expansion of the balance sheet, call it whatever you will, perhaps don't use quantitative easing because it is controversial, do you think that that is supporting a rally much more than some people are allowing?
I think it is absolutely helpful. It does show that the Fed put, and we all hate that phrase, but it's real. The Fed put applies to a whole range of things, including things like the repo market, and they want to make sure that the system continues to work as it should. So I think it's a comforting notion. I don't know how much it directly affects stock prices, but let's put it this way. It helps more than it hurts.
Thanks to Nick Colas, co-founder of DataTrek Research. Coming up, the latest on U.S.-China trade. This is Bloomberg. From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. The U.S. and China are arranging the formal signing of the first phase of a broader trade deal between the world's two biggest economies on January 15th. President Donald Trump said this after discussions between him and his counterpart, Xi Jinping. Henrietta Trace, managing partner and head of economic policy at Veda Partners, discussed trade earlier with Bloomberg's Tom Keene and Jonathan Farrow.
Henrietta, what is a phase one agreement? And have we actually got a translation yet in Chinese and in English?
So far, there is not. There is expected, so there's no translation. There's no legal text. We haven't seen a publicly available, you know, what is expected to be around an 86-page document that lays out exactly what China is committing to and the process by which U.S. companies can go and file claims to express that they are still seeing their IP stolen or their tech being forced transferred, all those components that are pieces of the initial phase one deal. We will not ever see the commitment from China on commodities purchases. The United States is explaining that that is something that could potentially distort commodity prices. And that's an area of great concern for U.S. farmers because they really want to see language around what Brazil and Argentina are going to be continuing to do with China. They're worried about ceding market share in the long term to those two nations. But the understanding I have is that on as early as Saturday, the 4th, Vice Premier Liu He and USTR Lighthizer could really ink a deal and agree to legal text. And then President Trump will do whatever he's going to do on January 15th in the White House.
Okay. Has anybody seen the deal? To John's question, is it unusual that there's a big mystery about what's in 86 pages?
No, I don't think it's particularly unusual. I mean, there is a chance that things could go sideways, of course, as there always is. China has backed out of committing to last-minute legal ramifications before, and that really is the crux of this. One of the things that the United States is concerned about is whether or not the translation contains binding language. So should China commit to IP reforms or shall China commit to IP reforms? You know, one sounds binding, the other sounds more optional. And that's really the final stage that they're in right now.
They're into words. They're into like one word usage.
Exactly. And words are everything, as we've discussed for over a year now. You know, that's something that has broken this up before. So there is a scenario where this could fall apart. There is some reporting just in the last few days that the president's tweeting specifically about January 15th should be worrisome to folks because it suggests that there was not a firm date set prior, and he's trying to force China's hand now by creating the optics that a deal has to be reached on the 15th. So that's a little bit disconcerting. But based off of what I'm seeing behind the scenes, the briefings that have gone on, both amongst Republican staff, Democratic staff, House, Senate, and then also the trade associations and individual businesses, the White House went fast and furious on a full-scale rollout with their legal team explaining to every vested interest exactly what's in the deal. So I do think that there is a lot of concrete text. It's not, you know, final as yet, but I would not expect for anything to implode at this point. And moreover, I think the White House has lost its appetite for further tariffs. So we're going to keep all the existing $360 billion worth of tariffs in place. None of those will come off in 2020, but we don't want to see more. And the White House has lost its appetite for more since about late August.
What have we heard from the Chinese government?
We've heard that they are coming here, that they are willing to sign a document. They are happy to not see tariffs escalate. They are happy to make purchases. On the troublesome side, we have heard that they are not willing to shut off any trade with foreign counterparts that allow them to have open access. And there's obviously a lot of talk about whether the United States trying to limit Brazil and Argentina's trade with China would be a violation of the WTO. And China has seized on that, I think. So pushback where necessary and capitulation to stave off worse.
Is Huawei or specific company technology involved in this phase one?
It is not involved in this, and USTR Lighthizer goes out of his way to explain that that is the Department of Commerce's purview and the Bureau of Industry and Security's purview. It does come up in every single meeting, I'm advised. So I don't think that it's something that anybody is not aware of, but it is not the focal point, and it is not addressed in the phase one deal at all, to my knowledge.
Phase two, let's talk about that. The president also saying he'll go to Beijing, Henrietta. He'll go to Beijing where talks will begin on a second phase of the deal. What goes into phase two? And if the Chinese are unwilling to sign up to any binding legal enforcement measures in phase one, what hope do you have for phase two, where things could get a whole lot trickier?
I have no expectations for phase two, nor do I have any expectations for President Trump to go to Beijing. I think that that's something that we've seen from President Trump before. There was speculation as far back as September and then again in October and November that President Trump would be traveling to Beijing. So I am not optimistic that that's got any veracity behind it. And I would say that the most important thing about phase two is that it would include a discussion about state subsidization in China, which is integral to their economy and something they've been pretty clear is off the table for at least the time being. So I am not expecting phase two, although, of course, there will have to be a discussion in it around it, particularly as we get into the 2020 U.S. presidential election.
Thanks to Henrietta Treyes, managing partner and head of economic policy at Veda Partners. Coming up, we'll look back at the life of former NBA Commissioner David Stern. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on DNA testing and how it could be used in unanticipated ways with Bloomberg's Kristen V. Brown.
The situation.
What's interesting about DNA testing is that what we've gotten has been less about healthcare and a lot more about other things, like ancestry, connecting with family members, and in some cases, even things like solving crime.
The background.
DNA data is really personal, right? It is you. It's the code that makes you. So if you have that data out there, that means people can find out information about you, like who you're related to, what kinds of healthcare problems you might be at risk for. And you can imagine if fallen into the wrong hands, that could be a problem.
The argument.
People have found really interesting ways to use this genetic information, and I think that we can just expect in the future there will be even more unexpected and unintended consequences of DNA testing.
For more on DNA testing or other quick takes, go to Bloomberg.com, or for terminal customers, go to NIQuick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
Broadcasting live from the Interactive Broker Studio in New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Best.
I'm June Grosso. David Stern, who was the longest tenured commissioner of any professional sport, transformed the National Basketball Association into a global multi-billion dollar powerhouse. He's passed away at the age of 77. Bloomberg's Scott Soschnick spoke earlier about Stern's legacy with Tom Keen and Paul Sweeney.
Socially, what Mr. Stern did, it was stunning, wasn't it?
Yeah, transformed the free agency of players.
Of all sports,
I would say. Absolutely, for sure. And David always took particular enjoyment in social change. He viewed the NBA as a vehicle of that change, and I would say the most glaring example of it was Magic Johnson and his HIV announcement. Yeah, that's right. Nobody, almost nobody, wanted Magic to participate in the All-Star game after his diagnosis, after he was no longer playing in the NBA.
Right.
David pushed for him to participate and altered the course of history.
And Paul, I want you to jump in here because you know a lot more about the bouncing ball sport than I do. But I will just say that this is like the death of Branch Rickey. That's the only equivalency.
It's amazing. So, Scott, just for our listeners who maybe don't remember, give us a sense of what the NBA was before David Stern.
It's hard for anyone who doesn't remember, wasn't there, to realize that the NBA Finals, a global spectacle now, was on tape delay.
Amazing. Yeah.
People didn't really know Magic Johnson and Larry Bird because they couldn't see them on TV. It's almost unthought of, unheard of nowadays. But David took a league that was thought of as too black, too filled with drugs, and transformed not only as an entertainment, a global entertainment property, but he made the players themselves, black players, and he took a lot of pride in this, global icons. He made the likes of Michael Jordan, Magic Johnson, and beamed those smiles and those talents to the world and made them iconic figures.
What I find is just amazing is that how the NBA, not the NFL, which is considered the big, you know, sports entity in the U.S., but the NBA really went global first, it seems like.
David understood. One of his entities is called Basketball Without Borders, and that's sort of growing the game internationally. But David understood, metaphorically, it is without. The world is flat. He actually had Tom Friedman talk to the owners years and years ago to explain to them this flat world and how technology will be used. So that one of my favorite stories of David's tenure, he took a bunch of officials to Thimphu, Bhutan, a one stoplight town. Okay,
I get fan mail from Thimphu, Bhutan.
Well, all right. Well, then maybe your homepage is up there as well. But David is touring the town with some officials, and they go to an internet cafe, and he said he looked over a kid's shoulder, and he had the Kobe Bryant NBA.com page up. It was that moment where it crystallized for David.
Interesting.
We got something here.
So right now, I mean, so many players in the NBA now are outside, far from outside the U.S. It's amazing.
The import and the export.
Yes.
He exported the game to the world, but he imported the world's best because he knew that if I'm going to get the world's most populous nation to pay attention to my product, it sure helps if they look like one of those players looks like me, came from where I am. Yao Ming made that happen.
This guy was so grounded. His father ran a Jewish deli, I believe, in New Jersey. He was with Prescott Rose, and that's
he was in Chelsea. Yeah, he ran Stern's Deli in Chelsea, and David worked on the weekends. And I mean, back then, you know, he was a Knicks fan, and he would wear his Harry the Horse Gallatin jersey.
What would he say about the navel gazing over how to save other sports? Now, I'm going to guess in basketball, maybe it's do you move the 3-point line out, whatever. But what would he say about the microanalysis of how to save hockey, how to save baseball, and the rest of it?
The pegs of his management style were micromanagement and fear. Like the worst thing that could happen to an employee at the NBA would be to step in the elevator, have it go down, stop on 15, they'd all go, uh-oh, hear the ding, have the doors open, and have David step in. Because he was going to quiz you for every floor you were going down on what was going on in the business. He knew your numbers better than you did. But he would say, pay attention to the game at its core. The game is everything.
Thanks to Bloomberg's Scott Soschnick. Coming up, a look at how media has evolved through the decades. This is Bloomberg.
With a Bloomberg Business of Sports report, I'm Michael Barr. It's one thing when you're a fan of a playoff-bound NFL team. Woohoo! It's another thing when your team has been on the business end of a beatdown. New York Giants co-owner Steve Tisch spoke after the firing of Pat Shermer as head coach after the team's 4-12 season. He lends empathy to fans, but says he believes he and co-owner John Mara will get the team back on track.
I say to the fans, I totally understand your frustration, your concern. I read your emails. I get it. But it's, you know, it's John and I make decisions that sometimes may not be popular, may not be supported by the fans, but, you know, we're the ones making the decisions. We live by them.
Other NFL teams that had droopy seasons, the Bengals at 2-14, the Redskins at 3-13, and the Lions at 3-12-1. And that is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Michael Barr.
From the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers Studio, this is Bloomberg Best. It's 47 minutes past the hour. Now it's time for Bloomberg Opinion.
Bloomberg Opinion. Informed perspectives and expert data-driven commentary on breaking news.
Bloomberg's Lisa Abramowitz and Paul Sweeney speak with Bloomberg Opinion columnist Justin Fox. They discuss his column, which takes a look at how the media business has evolved over the past few decades.
Justin, kind of frame out for us kind of how you looked at this business.
Well, basically, I just started looking at an old book that I had on my shelf by a guy who'd been a professor of mine in college, William Grider. And I did this a couple weeks ago. Grider died last week at the age of 83, but I was actually looking this up before then because I've been struggling for a while with the idea that something about our media environment is a big cause of why there's so much political polarization in the U.S. right now. There's a lot of underlying survey data and data about how people live their lives that sort of show that there's not some great new polarization in how Americans think, but there definitely is in how our politics gets expressed, and part of it is how the media has evolved. And, you know, one way is to think about that is, oh, it's all so awful that there's YouTube and talk radio and all these things other than us wonderful people in the mainstream media. But Grider's argument back in 1992 is that the mainstream media was sort of losing its grip in part because it had become this increasingly sort of establishment-oriented entity full of people with degrees from fancy colleges, which ironically, you know, Grider went to Princeton and I took a class from him there. So he was one of those early gentrifiers who later gets mad at it happening. But at the same time, I think he was right to some extent that their national media especially, but also a lot of regional papers became from this sort of feisty array of different voices, became this sort of centrist establishment voice.
Okay, Justin. So do you think that the more disparate spray of the way people get news and sort of more polarized way of the way people get news in terms of being able to curate their feeds on Facebook or and just follow people who agree with them or on Twitter, do you think that this is a preferable situation because at least it's democratized as opposed to just the establishment of sort of state reporters who all went to Ivy League schools?
I mean, if you'd asked me in the like late 90s, I would have said, oh, yeah, it's going to be great. And I do feel like in economics journalism, it has been great. There's a lot more voices that are able to weigh in, a lot more expert voices for the most part, actual economists.
Well, when people talk about this, they're not talking about
you're absolutely
Twitter.
Right.
They're talking about political Twitter.
Yeah. And there it really is a struggle because for all the problems with the mainstream media, at least it's mostly based on a culture of correcting errors when they're found and not making stuff up out of whole cloth. And that's definitely much less true in a lot of these newer media forms that have sprung up.
So, Justin, what do you make of, or just from the perspective of the media business in the United States, kind of how it's really evolved, I guess, the society's view of media, and it's probably been amped by this current president and how this president terms the media industry. Are we going to ever go back to kind of the way it was, do you think, perhaps, where the media was maybe a little bit more trusted, a little bit more considered to be less biased?
Well, one of the biggest problems is it used to be the economics of the media worked so that a lot of it had to be created close to where people were. And you know, newspapers in the U.S., that's where most of the news media was working at newspapers in cities all over the country. And that has just collapsed, especially over the past decade plus. And not necessarily, I mean, people were turning away, readers were turning away from that slowly already, but it was really the advertising model fell apart starting in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And and it makes me horribly sad. And I was a reporter in Tulare, California, and then in Birmingham, Alabama. And those places are just shells of what they once were, those newspapers. And it makes me awfully sad. I don't see how that comes back. It has to be some reorganization, and it's definitely been nationalized, and we're at this awful moment now where it seems like it's mostly generating distrust,
yeah,
rather than trust. And I don't know where it goes from there, but I also know that we have definitely had in the past of the United States, you know, very diverse media with lots of name calling and making stuff up about each other, and we seem to survive that.
Thanks, Justin. That's Justin Fox, a Bloomberg Opinion columnist. You can read more from Justin and other stories from Bloomberg Opinion at Bloomberg.com/opinion and on the terminal by typing OPIN Go. Now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Tom Busby, and on WBZ in Boston, I'll be reporting on three New England states making the top five of the healthiest states in the U.S.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on KTRH in Houston. Russia's crude output hit a post-Soviet high last year.
I'm Elisa Parenti on WBBM in Chicago. I'm reporting Boeing rival Airbus is capitalizing on the plane maker's woes, selling 860 planes last month.
I'm Ed Corey on WWJ in Detroit. I'm reporting automakers probably sold more than 17 million new vehicles for a fifth year in a row.
Thanks, Ed. Fast-growing southern and western states will gain more sway in Congress and in presidential elections in the 2020s at the expense of northeastern and midwestern states that are growing more slowly or even losing residents. California could lose a seat as Texas again adds multiple seats. That's according to an analysis of Census Bureau population projections. Bloomberg's Greg Giroux spoke about it earlier with Bloomberg's David Westin.
You wrote a terrific piece about exactly what we're looking at here. Who do we expect? We don't know yet, but who do we expect the winners and losers among the states to be come the end of this year?
Well, the South and the West will continue to gain congressional representation in the reapportionment that will be conducted after the census this year. The Sun Belt, states like Texas and Florida, but also Arizona, North Carolina, Colorado, and even Oregon is slated to gain a seat. So it's a continuation of a decades-long trend we've seen where population growth is much more robust in the South and in the West than in the Midwest and the Northeast, which are slated to lose seats because the reapportionment of the 435 districts is a zero-sum game. That number is fixed, so states in the South and West that gain seats necessarily do so at the expense of states that grow more slowly or that lose population.
And it's interesting, looking at the estimate that I saw coming out of census.gov, I learned something. California, of course, is the most populous state. That's going to be pretty blue, we expect. But Texas is the second most populous state, of course. There's almost 29 million people. And Florida, third. And New York comes in actually fourth. So you've got a couple of states that can or do go red in there.
Oh, that's right. Florida went narrowly for President Trump in the 2016 election, and Florida overtook New York since the 2010 census headcount to become the third most populous state. It's slated to gain two seats in the 2020 reapportionment, and therefore it will gain more political power in the Congress and then, of course, have a greater electoral vote allocation for the 2024 and 2028 presidential elections. The same with Texas, slated to gain three congressional districts to go from 36 to 39, Texas exploding in population. And President Trump carried that state by about 9 points in 2016. Not a close race, but much smaller margin for a Republican presidential candidate than in previous elections.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of speculation, maybe wish on some people's parts, but a lot of speculation that Texas, if not going blue, could go vaguely purple, that it's sort of been moving in that direction slowly.
I think it very well may. I think what we saw in 2016, that a lot of the urbanite and suburbanite populations in Texas and, you know, the 10 or 12 most populous counties in Texas, which has 254 counties, those 10 or 12 counties account for about two-thirds or even more of the vote in Texas. So it's a huge state geographically, a lot of rural areas, but a lot of the vote is still heavily concentrated in some counties that have been trending Democratic or are not voting as strongly Republican as they used to. I think Texas probably will be closer in 2020 than in 2016.
Yeah, we saw that perhaps a little bit in some of the off-year elections we had in Kentucky, Alabama, places like that, that even in states that may well go red, that the suburbs and the cities may be a bit more democratically inclined.
That's right. It's those areas, those populous suburban, inner suburban areas with high levels of education that have trended away from the Republicans since Donald Trump became the Republican nominee and was elected president. We see all that in states like Texas, but also in states like Arizona and even Georgia, states that are not voting as strongly Republican as they used to. I think Texas may be on the cusp of competitiveness in the 2020 presidential election, but it did have a very close U.S. Senate race with Ted Cruz barely winning in 2018. But also would watch Arizona and Georgia, states that are expanding in population as well and diversifying in population.
Thanks to Bloomberg's Greg Giroux. And that's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. You can see all of our best work at NI Best Go on the Bloomberg Terminal. Our show is produced by Mark Siniscalchi. I'm June Grosso, and this is Bloomberg.